Okay, so I grew up to parents from South Africa and from Zimbabwe, and basically discussions about social injustice were one of the main things we were discussing around the dinner tables over the weekends. My father was a writer and a journalist, and my mother was I could describe her as a bird watcher with a keen lust for storytelling and for adventure. And I'm telling you all this because I think that who we are is a lot about how we grew up and all the things we were exposed to during that process. And I'm sure that my interest in social matters and political matters came from that period of time. And also the lust for storytelling also is rooted in that period of time. So, okay, the first project I really did was called Southwest Jerusalem. It's an ongoing project, and it's about the neighborhood I grew up in and am living in today. It's working-class neighborhoods in southwest of Jerusalem. And this was a project I started doing while I was a student. And it in the last 2 years of my studies, and it carried on. It's still an ongoing project. But it's a project that's dealing with a very small territory geographically. And when I graduated, I decided that I would like to expand my interests under this umbrella of the social and political aspects that interest me, and that I would like to do a project that deals with the whole of Israel and not only a specific neighborhood that's, you know, that you could walk through it in half a day maybe or something like that. Now, as a kid, we never used to have a car, so I felt that I didn't really know Israel. I knew it from buses, from going from one place to the other by bus, but it wasn't like I had friends that every Saturday they used to pack the kids into the car, and they used to sort of go on these traveling around the place. So they really, I felt like I didn't really know the country I was living in from that point of view. And I decided that I'm going to start a project that's based on the idea of the American photography journey that started out as iMapIt at the late 19th century with Jackson and O'Sullivan in the States, you know, the early topographical photographers that set out to discover and to map America. Through the mid 20th century with photographers like Robert Frank and the Americans, and then all the photographers that came after like Joel Sternfeld, Stefan Shaw, and all this tradition of the photographic journey that was rooted in the American photographic history. And that was the blueprint for this project. And I started out knowing that I wanted to deal with these social and political aspects that exist in Israel, but I didn't really have the idea of how I'm going to do it because it was like a real new sort of blank page. And in the first 2 years, I remember it was very hard putting things into words because I was stopping in places, looking at things, making photographs, looking at them afterwards. And it took a while till I understood how this project was sort of, it had a sort of life of its own, a sort of, really a life of its own. It sort of started to shape itself in the making sort of thing. And all the time I was thinking about what I was seeing, what I was doing, and reevaluating things. The way I work, maybe this is time to say a bit about how I work. I work in, instead of going only forward, I also work sort of to the side. So I'm usually working on a few projects simultaneously. And so I kept on working on the project that's connected to Jerusalem. And simultaneously to this, I also started doing a project that's called The Legitimacy of Landscape, which is about the way the Arab villages in Israel and the territories are based in the landscape and how a place functions when a lot of the population is really afraid of that place and is ignoring it. But I'm just telling you this so you understand that I'm always working on a few things simultaneously, and these things are not they are connected and not connected also together. So all the things I'm thinking of are connected and not connected. So the way of thought or the way I'm building these projects is all about these interests that I find I'm dealing with in different ways in each project. In Jerusalem, I'm dealing with it with these working class neighborhoods. With the legitimacy of landscape, I'm dealing with it. With the way these Arab villages are existing in our geography, in our landscape, and in our minds, how they function. And in the quest for the man on the white donkey, I'm dealing with this in a sort of different way that deals with me going through the land trying to build a story. Now, the reason I gave this project the name The Quest for the Man on the White Donkey was that although I knew I was dealing with all these social aspects and political aspects, I wasn't thinking of the religious aspects that are connected to the country I'm living in. Well, I wasn't thinking of them in a sort of practical aspect till, I think the first time I really noticed it or thought about it was with the image over there with the girl sort of wading into the Sea of Galilee. And I was quite amused with the fact that it was the Sea of Galilee with all the stories, you know, of Jesus walking on the water and all that. And this little girl that she looks a bit like she's, you know, in the pose of being crucified. That sort of set out my imagination. And I started to think about how all these biblical stories and religious ideas that are connected to Judaism, to Islam and to Christianity are not only something that sort of exist in the books and in the sort of subconscious, but if we tentative enough, we might really see a sort of modern day materialization of these stories somehow happening in front of our eyes. And I think 3 years after I started the project, or maybe four, the man on the white donkey behind you guys came into my life. I was taking pictures around in the Judean desert, not really far from the Dead Sea. And I was already doing this. It was, I think, July, if I'm not mistaken. And it was really hot. It's like 40 degrees. And I use a very big camera. You British would call it a 10-8 camera. But it's like a small TV set on a tripod. And or an old TV set, and not the modern-day flat-screen things. And after 5 hours of working with this thing in the heat, you get quite tired, maybe a bit dehydrated. And I see this sort of figure coming out of the heat waves very slowly. And I swear to God, I was sure that I was hallucinating. But I was standing under a tree, and I said, okay, let's see what's happening here. And after about half an hour, the guy came up on his donkey, and we started talking for a while. And then I asked him to pose for a portrait, and he agreed. The donkey was moving like mad, because it was really hot, and also, you know, he didn't really want to be photographed, I think. And it took about an hour to make that portrait. I made three exposures. Three plates, and I remember focusing and refocusing and refocusing again. Now, this is a camera that your head is under a dark cloth, and every time you have to go out, and then you have to put the film, the cassette of film in, and it's like really 19th century practitioners of photography. And I remember thinking to myself that if one of them comes out sharp, it will be a miracle, flat out. And 2 weeks later, I developed the film, and I was looking at it on a light table, and I saw that the three plates came out sharp. And I was thinking to myself, what were the chances of this happening? Because I really remembered, you know, it was a very unique day. And that got me thinking about what this project was really about, you know. And that was, I think, around that month. I was thinking a lot about it that month. I came to the understanding that that the project could not only be about Israel's political, social climate, the way I'm experiencing it through going through the land, for my personal view, with my personal baggage, so to say, but it had to also include this religious aspect that's very much part of the country. And and then I started playing with the idea of really thinking of what should I name this project. And in Judaism, the Messiah or the prophet is supposed to arrive on a white donkey. And I could not stop laughing. You know, this was like a Monty Python moment when this Palestinian farmer came up to me on this white donkey, and I'm saying to myself, this is one of the paradoxes of the Israeli society. You know, you're expecting one thing, and then you're getting the other. And these sort of bizarre encounters very much shaped my project, because once you're going through the country, you cannot not meet all these people that, you know, some are Christians, some are Muslims, some are Jews, and when I'm saying this, saying a Christian or a Jew, it's such a wide term, because nowadays there's so many subcategories of everything. So you meet in all the subcategories of society, you know, just by stopping in a gas station or just by stopping at the side of the road. And I wanted this journey to represent all these encounters that I was coming upon with person and place. So this became very important, and that's what led me to give the project the name, The Quest for the Man on the White Donkey. And the quest was also, it came because I found myself not like the American tradition that the photographer was setting out and going in a certain linear direction with the car, you know, driving on and on and on and on, and he could carry on doing this for months at a time because the land was big enough. In Israel, it's so small that I found myself, I leave at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, I find myself at one of the borders, usually at noon. And if I'm, you know, if I'm really going far, let's say up north or down south, then it will take a day. And by evening, I'll be at one of the borders. So I found myself repeating myself again and again. You know, I was going through the same places again and again and again. And I understood that that basically I'm looking for something that that I can only see in my own eyes. It doesn't really exist in reality, because the more I looked at the images I was making, the more I asked myself, am I representing Israel in any way? And the answer was that no, I'm showing what I find interesting in the land that I'm part of, that most of the time, you know, as a local and Israeli born, I cannot say that I really understand the place I live in. Maybe you guys cannot really relate to that because you've got a very long, long history in Europe, in England, that I'm sure you feel very much part of. But Israel's a very young state, and it's a very complicated place to live in. And sometimes you wake up in the morning thinking one thing because you hear something on the news, and by an hour later you think something else because you've heard something else on the other bulletin of news. So this is the kind of place I live in, and somehow I managed to survive in it. But when I was looking at the work I was doing, I never really thought that this would, you know, people ask me, is this representing Israel in any way? And I always say it only represents the way I find, you know, the things I encounter in the country. Just a second, please. So that's how the project got its name. And once the project had its name or got its name, I found it it sort of speeded up, and somehow I started noticing more the things that I wanted to deal with, and I was wasting less time, so to say, with figuring out the things I was looking at and how they could or couldn't work in the context of the project. So In the end, I was talking to Pippa about this yesterday, but in the end, when the way I think I should maybe say a bit more about the way I work. I take pictures around something around 9-10 months a year, and I develop them. I look at them once on a light table just to see what came out, and then I usually put them in a box. And I stack them up by boxes, in boxes by topics, and then I edit in summer. I do this so I'm not emotionally connected to the images, because I find that I also teach quite a bit, and I see the emotional connection that photographers have with the images they make, and sometimes they fall in love with an image and then they just can't let it go. And this is a system that I've developed to sort of distance me from the work, because all the encounters and all these photographic days that I go out, I come back super hyped up and very excited, because I meet a lot of interesting people. I get into a lot of situations, some of them a bit risky, some of them very nice. And all this is something that, you know, it takes a while to forget about. So my system is to put the work away, and then when I edit, I reevaluate it only by the topic that I'm working with you know, the idea of the body of work, and I don't remember these encounters, or not in a way that it's so strong that it influences me to choose an image or not. Sometimes I even forget some of the images that I've taken them. You know, I look at it and I say, did I take this? You know, so this happens occasionally. It sounds maybe weird, but I take a lot of pictures. And sometimes even this happens. So around 2008, I started to understand that this body of work should be an extensive body of work in the end, and that I'd like to represent it in a book, because that is when you're doing a show, even a large-scale one like we're doing here, we've only got 20-something pieces in it. How about 27? And I noticed that every time I edited this body of work every year, I couldn't narrow it down to less than 100. So I started thinking that the book would be a better way, maybe, or a more complete way, to show the work parallel to exhibitions. And in 2009, I started to edit in the idea of narrowing down these thousands of photographs. I think there's between 1,000 and maybe 2,000 pictures in this body of work. I think it's closer to 2,000. And to start to think of how I'm really going to finish this body of work. So the book really it's like it gave me a sort of deadline to do these things. And at the end, this project contains 85 images. And when I was editing for this, sort of final edit of the project, final edit of the book, whatever I decide to call this thing, I decided that I was thinking a lot of the definition of the work, because lots of people think of me as a documentary photographer, but the way I look at these things is that I'm actually, I would describe what I'm doing as narrative based on documentary style photography. And I'm using reality, but I'm using it to build a story. And the story is very important in this context, and the context of the edit. So I was really editing by what each image means in this story, and how each image would connect to the whole story at large and have a specific angle of its own. Each one has to have that specific angle. It wasn't by good or bad images. It was by what each image could contribute to the story that I'm trying to tell in this body of work. So each of the portraits, let's start with the portraits, because the portraits, it's more obvious. Each of the portraits has to had in it a sort of, he represented a certain archetype of someone living on this land, be it Israeli, be it Palestinian, from the people that I encountered, from the people that I encounter on my daily, in my daily life. Also, my life is very much moving around Israel, also for my teaching purposes. And so each of the portraits really represents a certain archetype in the Israeli society. And also the places itself, the places or the landscapes as people call them, but I think of them more as pictures of objects in the landscape. And these things, each one has a sort of clue in them or is a metaphor to something that represents the way I see Israel in a way. Just to, not to kill all the images, but just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. There's a picture over there with the carpet that's embedded in an archaeology site, and it looks like a Persian rug. And I think of Israel a lot like Rome in a way, you know, that it's built out of layers. And this one's like a temporary layer in this, you know, in this mass of layers that is an archaeology site. And I found that very sort of metaphorical in a way to the way this land is. So each of the images has this sort of clue in it. And another thing that I was focusing on, or I found myself stopping again and again in the landscape, was these abandoned places. And I find that in Israel, once a use of the place is sort of, once somebody finishes using the place, then it's usually just abandoned as is till somebody else decides to rent it, buy it, and then develop it in a different way. So these things talk a lot about the people living on this land. They are very referential for me to the way we are living in this country. What else did I want to say? I think that's about it. Pepe, is there anything else that we want? Okay, so well, I always feel that each of the images in this body of work, or in general, that any image that in the end lands up in the edit has a huge, of any body of work, has a huge amount of luck to it. Because I call this luck, because there are so many things that had to come together in a particular way for the image to really happen. Now, here, this is an area that I wrote a bit about in the extracts that are in the middle of the book. And it's this sort of abandoned Jordanian base that moved, it became part of Israel in 67, I think. And it's nowadays, and then the Israeli army had a base in there, and then the Israeli army abandoned it. So it's been around, I think, from the 30s or 40s, or, you know, somewhere around there, maybe 40s. And now it's an abandoned place. And this place is called the Dead Sea Hilton. I think soldiers gave it that name, because it's like a bad joke, I think. But this specific place was a restaurant, a Jordanian restaurant. And around here was the bandstand. And all around were the chairs, you know, the tables and chairs. And we stopped there. Sometimes when I go on these photographic journeys, then a friend comes with me. Just usually sometimes it's a photographer friend. Sometimes it's just somebody that had enough of his day job and wants a day off. And he knows that he'll just come traveling with me for a day. So this is the person that basically came with me that day. He's also a photographer. And he's religious, and he asked me, this is about 6 o'clock in the morning, and he asked me, can we stop so I say the morning prayer? So I said, yeah, sure, you know, I won't stop you from doing what you need to do. So we stopped there, and I was sort of looking around to see if there was anything interesting for me. I think it's one of the most photographed places in Israel, except the Wailing Wall and the Dome of the Mosque in Jerusalem. Because every photographer that comes to Israel, I think, has an image in this place, which even amused me more when I decided to keep it in the body of work, because it's not something that I would naturally do. But I found it it has its two elements to it. One is in the context of the work, and this sort of represents the way modern Judaism works for me today, because people just stop their cars anywhere if they need to pray, and they pray. This is how it goes. And in Islam, it's also like that, by the way. They just need, you know, they just need to wash their hands, and I'm not sure about the feet. And also, they just need something clean to pray on. So it also can happen in many places, outside or whatever. And this is one of the things that are connected between both religions, in my understanding anyway. So this represents that angle in sort of the common religious Israeli society. Now, not every Orthodox Jew would do something like this. It's only a certain type of Orthodox Jews that will, you know, stop in the middle and pray outside. Most of them would organize their life very meticulously to be in the right place at the right time to do what they're supposed to be doing. And in the book, there's another image that sort of deals with this sort of daily worshiping aspect. It's a guy praying in the gas station. You know, he's stopped the car, he's filling it up with gas, and he's putting on the tefillin and the talit, which is, you know, part of the daily morning prayer. So that's the one angle of it. And the other angle was, you know, sort of making a small bow to all the photographers that have stopped in this spot before me. Which, you know, I think this body of work, everybody takes it very, very seriously. But if you really stop and look at it, you'll find that it's serious, but it also has a lot of humor in it. Because I think that you cannot live nowadays in Israel without a certain amount of humor. And this is repetitive in, I think, not all the pictures, but in some of them anyway. I think that maybe we'll start with questions. So feel free to ask me whatever's on your mind. You have another one? Okay. To them. Okay. Well, the people that are in these images are people I do not know. And one of the reasons I should have maybe talked about that previously, because I remember Pippa asking me to. And one of the reasons I use a 10-8 camera is or a view camera. It's mostly 8x10, but some are done also 4x5. Is the fact that it generates, first of all, it makes me very accurate. It makes me really look at what I'm photographing and make a very decisive decision on when to make the image. And this is because it's just very, very expensive process, the whole thing. And that makes you very, very accurate. The other thing is it generates a photographic moment. I'm out there with this huge equipment on a tripod. Just a second, please. Sorry about that. And people notice me. So that's one of the ways that I'm working. You know, I'm out there with the camera, and people are coming and asking me what I'm doing. And most of the time I show them what I'm doing. I let them have a peek under the cloth of the camera, and they look, and sometimes people that interest me, sort of they come to me, and that's one of the ways these portraits are happening. And sometimes I just ask people to participate, and sometimes they agree and sometimes they don't. Some of the images came about. If you're asking if I'm bringing people to places to make images, the question is no. These are all people that are doing what they are doing in this, you know, and I'm sort of noticing it in the certain moment, or noticing them and asking them to participate in that same space and in those minutes that we are having the conversation. The soldier over there came to arrest me because that one is also done in the same place as this one is. And this is also, it's considered a closed military zone because it's on the border with Jordan. And he came to see what I was doing there. He came with another bunch of soldiers to see what's going on. They saw people, you know, with tripod and so on. And I asked the guy with me to talk to the commander while I was doing that. So, and this happens a lot. You know, I've been nearly arrested for quite a few times because a lot of the places I'm in are not, I'm not really supposed to be in. But this is also one of the things about Israel, that a lot of the places are not really, you know, there's not really, you don't really know if it's okay or not. I'm not talking about the times that I'm not really asking those questions, but even in daily life, you know. I remember talking to a photographer friend named Mickey Kratzman. He's the head of the department in the Bezalel school that I teach in Jerusalem. And he said that once he stood with a news crew on road 443, which is in the territories, and he asked people that were filling up their cars with gas if they ever were in the territories. And most of them said no, while they were standing in it. So so that just shows you how, you know, in the Israeli reality, a lot of things are not really one way sort of understandable. So it sounds maybe weird, but that's how it is. So unless you get to a sort of check post with soldiers, and even then, you know, sometimes you just pass it with nobody asking too many questions. So that's how these portraits came about. It's people I don't know. I bump into them on the way. And if they are interesting for me, then I stop and ask them to pose. I believe a lot that what you're looking at is very much influenced by how you're looking at it. And if I think about one of the main influences for this body of work, it is a book by an Italian author named Italo Calvino, and it's called The Invisible Cities. And this book, if I sum it up by in a few sentences, is about how much you are putting into what you're looking at. And I think that it's quite interesting because it's not that I'm standing there with a megaphone asking everybody to clear out, even though on occasion I might think of doing it. But but the truth is, it's just how I see things. Now, I'm not saying, you know, if there was somebody standing behind this guy here, I may, on occasion, ask him to move politely. But somehow, I'm the way I decide on who's interesting and how to position him in his surroundings just happens without me thinking a lot about it. It's something, it's more like as if it's already built into my mind, and I just need to finalize it in a way. It's a true answer, by the way. I'm not trying to get around your question. That's how it is. Don't be shy. Of course, the whole history of them. No, but I think this body of work is, of course, influenced by all the ones I stated before, like Stefan Shaw, Joel Sternfeld, and I think of this body of work as, in a way, like a small homage to the American tradition. But this is, you know, only one element in it. It's like, I think in Israel there's not this history of art that you guys have in Europe, and of course also in the States. In the States they have a very respected tradition to photography also. And in Israel, it's like, I feel like it's all adopted practices. And in this body of work, I really feel I'm paying homage to that element. But I think that I was much more influenced by literature in this body of work than from photographers. But of course, look, if we're talking about all-time influences, and I cannot not think, or I always think about August Sander in the sense of portraiture, because I think he was crucial to common practices of portraiture photography today, and of Eugène Ajette in Paris in roughly the same periods, that was also, you know, was just as crucial to urban, let's say, practices in landscape and typology. We can talk about this a lot, but these are two people that are really, I think, important in the way I'm looking at places and at people, and, you know, trying to. But I can't say that this body of work was influenced that much by more photographers than I already stated. But Italo Calvino and the Invisible Cities was very, very important. I think there also, of course, Kerouac. The whole idea of traveling, you know, in the States in the 60s and 70s also, you know, the just traveling around also very much influenced it. And also another few writers, but I can't remember their names in English now. You want to say?
Not particularly.
Well, I didn't either. Right. Just give it a time.
Okay, sorry. I was asking the question, when you're planning your journeys, or do you plan your journeys by looking at a map or looking at a certain aspect and deciding then to go to that place?
Okay, so the question was if I plan my journeys, if I'm looking at the map, or how do I plan my journeys, basically. So, I'm a combination of a Westerner and a chaotic Middle Easterner. And I'm a big believer in chance. So what I usually do is I set a direction. I say, okay, today I want to travel to the Golan Heights, or today I want to travel down north, or up north, or down south. And I set up usually with one idea of one place I want to stop on the way, but usually I never get to my destination. I usually stop so many times on the way that I'm sidetracked easily. And it's not really important to me where I'm going, but, you know, what I encounter. And some days you can just drive around for hours and hours and hours and not find anything that's worth stopping or worth photographing anyway. And some days you know, I get stuck in a very short, a very small geographical area, which I find intriguing. I'm particularly in the final edit, and in general, I find that I'm particularly attracted to the Bika area, the Jordan Desert, and it's called the Jordanian Valley. It's basically like it's an area going down from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea, and then you sort of turn left towards the Sea of Galilee. And so it's quite a big area, but I find that area very much intriguing. And it also has this sort of biblical feel to it today, even today that, you know, Israel is developing very much like every place, because all the overpopulation, that people have to live somewhere. So it's becoming, you know, settlements are becoming bigger and bigger, villages are becoming bigger and bigger, cities are becoming bigger and bigger. So that area somehow still has this open space feeling to it, which I very much find interesting. But I'm a very big believer in chance. I, you know, a lot of the places I think will be interesting because I've seen them, when I come back to them or not. You know, and you stop for 2-3 minutes and you understand that it's gone, what you saw there and what you felt there. Because we always are thinking of photography as if we're taking pictures of things. But at the end of the day, we're taking pictures of the way the light is illuminating those things. And, you know, these are things that are very dynamic. And also our mood is very important. You know, because if I go out in a certain mood, I'll be attracted to certain things. And if I go out in another mood, it will generate a different kind of photographic process. And this is true to also the way I'm reacting to places, and certainly to how I'm reacting to humans, and how, you know, because who you are, you project out. Maybe I should say also something I was meaning to talk about and I forgot, that I see myself very much like a blue-collar photographer. I don't see myself as, you know, I'm like a working-class photographer. And I think this is very important because people are not stupid. They don't need to be educated. Even, you know, they don't need to go to even one class in school. They can sum you up in half a second. And I think you asked that question. I'm not sure I answered it. But I always speak in Hebrew no matter where I am, because even if I speak in English, they'll know that I'm Israeli in a second. And then they'll say, what's this monkey business? You know, why is he doing this? And then they will not believe me. So I'm always sincere in presenting myself. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, all the political climate and everything, people are just people. And once they sort of see that I'm just really interested in what I'm doing, they don't necessarily understand what I'm doing. Most of them, I guess, think I'm quite mad with this huge camera and everything. But they have a certain empathy to me, and that's, I think, also part of the reason that they agree to participate in my project. Because it's not to take for granted that, you know, making a portrait can take half an hour, an hour with this camera. And these people are stopping in the middle of their daily life to humor me in a way. You know, and I respect that a lot. And also, you know, it's interesting. Some of them just evaporate afterwards because I always try and give them a print afterwards. And I've got a few prints in my car. Let's say I'm looking for the man on the white donkey ever since. And another few people that I didn't, you know, I lost the piece of paper I wrote down their contacts on, or they just, you know, the phone numbers have changed and all kinds of things like that. And sometimes it really feels like they were just there for the project, like they weren't really existing. Now, I know this sounds like New Age religion and that. I'm not this type, but it's really, once you get into a mode of looking at reality in a certain way, it somehow feels like you're inflicting that mode on reality, and that it's like it's starting to happen because you want it to happen or because you think it may happen. And anyway, that's my, it sounds a bit weird, but that's how it is.
I've got a couple of questions. You talked about the way in which the light affects how you view and what you shoot. And I'm interested to know, do you work alone or do you have an assistant? Because that the picture on the end in particular, I'm interested in how that's lit. Have you used a reflector to illuminate her face? Yeah. Okay.
No, I do not work. I do not work with assistants, and I work alone. Sometimes there's somebody with me, but usually he's if he's not a photographer, he's usually just sitting around, having a smoke, you know, or something like that, and just enjoying his day off. And if it's a photographer, he's off doing his own thing somewhere in the, you know, in the quite close, you know, in a kilometer or something away. So he's not really with me most of the time, because it can be very boring, this thing I'm doing. You know, it sounds like, it looks like from the pictures maybe interesting, I hope, but when you're doing it, you know, it's hot. You're sweaty, and you're carrying around a lot of equipment, I won't go into all the details, but anyway, so and there's no reflector. Anyway, I always carry one around with me, but I hardly ever. I don't think that in any of the portraits I've ever used it. Actually, it's just like one of these things that's in the camera bag, and it's. The light is a backlight in that image, and it's just a matter of how you expose. And also, you learn to look. I don't know how to, also, this is something I always am trying to teach to my students, how to really look at the light, to see it. And once you learn how to do that, it sort of also embeds itself into your sort of consciousness, and you just use it, you know? I don't know, this is not making much sense because there's no way of explaining this in a in a linear way. It's part of being a photographer.
Print from the negs directly, or if these have been scanned. I mean, are the smaller ones 5.4 and the larger 8.10? How have they been put together, or is there any post-production other than maybe cropping?
In Israel, there's one place you can put directly from the negatives from 8x10 nowadays. When I started using 8x10 in 2000 and 2000 or 2001, it was I bought into consideration that I will have to bring the film from the States. That's the one thing, which is super complicated as is. And the other is that I could not print myself the images. And I've come to terms with this thing, and I've learned to also to love it. So what I do is I scan the negatives or slides. This body of work has been taken on negatives and slides. And then, you work on it on the computer. They are hardly cropped, I must say. I believe in one of the reasons I like these cameras is that you really see the image, and then you build it while you edit while you're going. You're not, if it's not good enough, you usually do not take the photograph. So it's just cropped around millimeters or something like that. And no, the small ones are not 4x5s and the big ones 8x10. I'm traditional and romantic, but not in that aspect. And it's just a matter, this body of work exists in three sizes, which were decided upon by me so when I do an exhibition, I can make it more dynamic in a way and more interesting. And and every time we sort of try to evaluate it by the space we're showing the images in. That's about it. 4x5 is enough to print the biggest size I print. I don't use this camera from that aspect. I like the 8x10 because it really focuses me. You know, you see the image and you make the decisions, and I don't know, every photographer finds the tool that works best for him, and at this moment, this is it. I'm not saying, it might change.
He's shot sort of about 20, 24,000 photographs of his project in Poland, and yet he uses large format camera. He goes back and revisits the space with the big camera once he's found the space photographically. Is that something you do, or do you only, for this body of work, only shoot large format and no support digital 35mm?
No support. Look, it's easy, but I find that if I'm doing these sort of, previous skit shots, demi shots, sketch shots, then usually they come out good and the actual photograph comes out very bad. So I've tried that once or twice, and it's terribly disappointing when a digital picture comes out okay, and then you cannot use it because it doesn't fit in formally to the body of work. It's just a different formal language, and I live in both worlds. I'm a product of the analog world, and I'm also a product of modern day life. And I use digital cameras for a bit of commercial work I do. And not only that, I'm always trying to think of how I can use this tool that's connected to this era in photography, because photography has always been connected to technological changes. And I find that something that I want to relate to in my work, not only to the history of the medium, but also to the current position of it in its state now. So I've got quite a good digital camera, and I'm always trying to find how I can use it in a way that suits the medium, but I still haven't come up with something. I'm playing around with it quite a lot in all kinds of ways, but no. And I don't believe in this using it just to do and then to think of the place and what I want to do. It's not that my way of working is very much spontaneous and very much connected to how things have just happened in that specific moment. And if I miss that, it will never be the same. This sounds maybe weird, and maybe with the portraits it's more understandable because the people will never be there again, you know. But with the places it's the same, because even the place changes. It changes not only the light, it changes the season, it changes by if there are people or not people there, if there are people, who the people are, and a thousand other things. And it changes by the mood of me when I'm going through it. So I make it an issue always to take with me, if I'm going to take pictures, I'm not one of these people that are carrying a camera around everywhere, but when I go to take pictures, I'm taking the camera with. And that's how it goes. It's no, I revisit the places again and again, but always with the camera itself. There's two gentlemen there that want, so let's do them both, no? Yeah, okay.
You talked about maintaining an emotional distance, really, in putting your work in a box and then going back to it when, if you like, the emotional connection has gone. What are the advantages of that for you?
Editing by mind and not by heart.
You could expand on that.
Look, it's very complicated, the whole business, as you probably can imagine. But in every picture here has a story behind it. And that story is something that I remember as it is, or in most cases. And I don't want the story to be the reason for me putting the image in the edit, and not the image itself and the way it will function and the sort of what it would generate. You know, what sort of intellectual tweaking it will generate when the people are looking at, or may generate, when the people are looking at the book or the project. And just a second. I'll use this tissue again. So I'll give you another sort of input into it. This image was taken in Nebi Musa. Nebi Musa is this, it's in the Judean, desert. And it's like, it's an area where there's a mosque. It's very desolate, you know, it's very, there's nothing there. There's a graveyard and the mosque, basically. And when I came there, I was looking around. I actually came to take a picture of the graveyard, but it wasn't interesting that day. And I met this young guy. And we started talking, and we decided to do a portrait. And I positioned my camera next to a Toyota truck. It was like facing, the truck was like on the side. And this huge Bedouin guy came out of the mosque and was sure that I was taking a picture of his truck. Now, when I'm saying huge, he's about three times your size. And he just came up to me. He picked up the tripod with the 8x10 with two fingers, and I'm not exaggerating, and was about to throw it aside. And it took me, I don't know how I managed to convince the guy that nothing was happening, that his truck wasn't in the picture, and that I was inflicting no harm on him or anything he owned. But somehow I tried to explain to him that he's acting in a very irrational way. And I don't know how I kept my calm, because I was really panicking, you know. I wasn't liking the idea that he would ruin my camera in one sort of thing. And in the end, he just swore at me and just put down the camera and kept on swearing until he drove away. Now, this is something that you cannot forget. You know? And I'm trying to put this in nice words because we're recording it, but you know, and this guy, he was lovely. He just said to me, "Listen, forget this guy. He's mad. You know, he's completely nuts. Forget it." And I think that, you know, if that wouldn't have happened, he wouldn't have been looking at me in that way. And, you know, these small things can be much stronger than the image. You know, the stories behind them. And I'm trying not to think of this or only this when I'm editing, because I have to have clues to the stories, or at least clues in the image that make the viewer react in various ways for justifying the image to be in the project. Because if not, it's just me and my memories, you know, of what happened. So this is not something I want to be to take place, you know, to influence me that much when I'm editing. I have to be as rational as I can. And I've become very rational when editing. It took years. Photographers are terrible editors usually. And I'm improving. Anyway.
No, another one because we have to be forced.
You know, I may not be aware, in fact, I'm sure I'm not. I'm not sure what a working class photographer is. But what I would like you to elucidate for me is, because Israel is such an emotive issue, I myself, practically impossible to be impartial. I want to know, at the end of your odyssey, if you've become a politically engaged photographer. Mm. Is that a reasonable question?
I don't know, but I'll try and answer. He's very polite, so. No. Do you want him to repeat it? It's a complicated answer.
Question.
Well, first of all, I'll answer the first part. When I said that I'm a working class photographer, I really mean it. I live, you know, in a very low class area. I do a lot to do what I'm doing. You know, I give up a lot of other things to do what I'm doing. And not only that, I don't see myself as someone that's coming from the outside world commenting on a new world that he's exposed to. I see myself as one of the people commenting on the other people that I'm connected to. And I think that in a way my photography is my way of being engaged politically, but I don't see photography's role in life, or in my life anyway, to use it in a very activistic manner, because that's not my character. And also, I believe in subtle ways of doing things, and not in in pushing things. And I think that when looking at these images, you can catch the undercurrent of this. And yes, you know, even that I live there and am very much part of the place and of the people, I can't tell you that I really understand the place I'm living in. I don't think anybody really does. You can see this from the elections that just happened now. People, you know, everybody I know, each of them was choosing, you know, was electing somebody from default just because, okay, what's the best we can do out of the bad? Sort of thing, but I never thought of this as a sort of political journey. You know, it's looking at life, and when I say looking at political aspects, I mean how they are existing in our reality, and not, you know, this is very much not what you'll see on BBC and CNN, I'm sure. Anyway, thanks. Thank you all for coming.